With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we have this week's almond update, but our top stories today: mild weather throughout December is affecting both winter wheat crops and western mountain snowpacks. Rod Bain has more.
So far this short winter season, the predominant weather pattern nationwide has been mild.
And we're seeing that not just in the central, but also the western United States.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for winter wheat growing areas in much of those regions,
we have seen favorable overwintering conditions to this point,
creating the best winter wheat growing conditions since 2019.
But it does potentially leave the crop vulnerable to future cold outbreaks. That is something we'll have to keep an eye on as we head into the new year. If we do get any sharp, even if they're short-lived cold outbreaks, could cause harm to this wheat crop.
Meanwhile, western mountain snowpack accumulations have been minimal due to the mild weather. However, a high-elevation snow system is expected this week over the Sierra Nevada range in California and Nevada.
And that should help to improve the numbers at least ever so slightly as we move toward the holidays.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey notes mild weather conditions in the West to start the annual mountain snowpack accumulation season.
We've talked about this warm autumn and early winter weather, and that has had implications for western snowpack to this point. With just a few exceptions, we have seen subpar snowpacks building up so far in our key watershed western mountain areas, the areas that supply moisture for irrigation and other purposes when we come to the spring and summer of 2024. Now, when you look at California, we are coming off that remarkable wet and snowy winter that led to breaking of the drought. And so we're still getting by on some of that moisture. But so far this season, we have seen very little snow accumulating in the Sierra Nevada, which is California's key watershed area for much of northern and central California. As of mid-December, we have seen less than 2 inches of water equivalency in the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. That is just about one quarter of normal for this time of year. Now, we're still a long way away from even the midpoint of the season, which would occur in late January. So there's still plenty of time to make up this deficit, but it is worth noting that we're off to a slow start.
With the recent House passage of the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act, attention now turns toward the Senate to take action. Michael Clements has the story.
National Milk Producers Federation Senior Director of Government Relations and Head of Nutrition Policy, Claudia Larson, explains what's next for the legislation in the Senate.
Its own version of the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act was introduced in June of this year by Senator Roger Marshall from Kansas and Senator Peter Welch from Vermont. There are 10 additional Senate co-sponsors, 6 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and 1 Independent. So we do know there is broad bipartisan support for this bill in the Senate. Now, whether or not the Senate picks up its own measure or picks up the House-approved bill, we're not entirely sure, but hopefully we'll see one of those two measures move and we can continue to advance this important bill.
Larson says the legislation can improve child nutrition by expanding the milk options schools can serve as part of breakfast and lunch programs.
Milk is a nutrition powerhouse. Milk at all fat levels provides 13 essential nutrients, nutrients the kids need to grow and thrive. Yet school-aged children and adolescents are not consuming these vital nutrients, and we must provide kids with healthful options that they will choose to actually drink. So the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act is a common sense approach to address this underconsumption of critical nutrients because it expands the options that schools can choose to serve to include 2% in whole milk.
She says parents and children both prefer whole and 2% milk.
By increasing access to whole and 2% milk, what we're doing is we're increasing kids' access to the nutritious milk options that are more popular, they're more commonly chosen. A recent survey of American parents actually demonstrates that 8 in 10 parents think the 2% and whole milk are the healthiest options for their kids. They're choosing that for their children at home. And we believe by providing these healthy, popular options at schools, we can continue to see kids consume and intake these vital nutrients.
Larson says there are ways you can help ensure children have access to whole and 2% milk at school.
One would be to email, call, write your senator, ask them to support the Whole Milk for for Healthy Kids Act, hoping for them to advance either their version or the House-approved version. Another way someone can become an advocate for whole milk would be to become involved in the dietary guidelines updating process, which is in the works right now. Online, you would just go to regulations.gov and then search for the 2025 dietary guidelines, where you can be an advocate for whole milk and really encourage the dietary guidelines process to incorporate this newer science on whole fat milk, which demonstrates its health benefits across all ages.
Learn more at nmpf.org. Michael Clements reporting.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says poultry companies don't need more time to implement new USDA rules on contract transparency. Here's Gary Crawford.
Some lawmakers and poultry integrators want USDA to delay by 180 days its implementation of new rules on contract transparency, rules scheduled to go into effect in mid-February. In Washington Tuesday, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told reporters he's against the delay that's being requested by poultry integrators.
They had multiple months of information about this to prepare for it. So I don't, candidly, I don't see any reason to extend the time period. I mean, they had plenty of time, and it's not as if what's being asked is particularly onerous. This is information they already have, very easily available.
And Vilsack added,
what we're not going to do is we're not going to delay the important work of providing a more balanced relationship between producers and integrators.
A relationship, Vilsack says, has been out of balance in favor of the integrators for far too long. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. For today's National Spotlight, we go to Chuck Zimmerman.
I'm visiting with Mary Kay Thatcher with Syngenta. And Mary Kay, tell us a little bit about what's going on at this point on the Hill with the Farm Bill.
Well, on the Farm Bill, on APROPES, on not shutting the government, essentially we're kicking the can down the road on all of them. So it's a real question about when or if those kind of things get done early in 2024.
When it comes to the Farm Bill, we had some movement, I guess, yesterday where we've got an extension, essentially, going to the president.
Oh, I think it'll be signed. And yes, it'll give us till September 30th of next year to pass the Farm Bill. But, you know, you don't pass on a Farm Bill very close to the election. So really, we've got till probably May, maybe June, where if we don't get this Farm Bill done, then it'll kick the can down the road to 2025.
You're right. We're going to be in an election year. And things, as it gets closer, it becomes more difficult for new legislation to get passed, right?
Well, and it very well may get more difficult for us next year anyway, because the Congressional Budget Office is going to tell us what kind of numbers do we have to work with in the funding of the Farm Bill, and they'll give us new numbers probably in March. And I think there's better than a 50% chance there's less money after then than we have right now. So that will make it even more difficult to write. You know, one can hope that we can prevail, but things are moving very slowly. And, you know, I think the Farm Bill is caught up in these same big picture fundamental issues, whether it's, you know, abortion pills for an APROPES bill, or whether it's how much are we going to cut SNAP, or it's, you know, does Debbie Stabenow prevail in keeping $18 or $20 billion in conservation programs, or do other people prevail in getting it moved to farm safety net programs? They're really big, you know, they're not tiny things to work out.
And you mentioned appropriations. I mean, that's been kind of a very different numbers have been floated out there that have not passed.
Oh, it's extremely different. You look at the ag appropriations from the House side and they cut funding by like 17%. And you look at the Senate side and they actually increased funding slightly. So how do you sit down in a conference committee and work out the difference when the numbers are that far apart? And then, of course, in ag appropriations, it's all about mailing this silly abortion pill out or not being able to do it. It really has nothing to do with ag appropriations, but that's one of the things very much holding up the bill.
What else are you working on for Syngenta? I mean, what are kind of, you know, the things that are most important to the company?
Well, I think the things most important to farmers right now ought to be watching EPA and what's going on there. And I know we all love to talk about the Farm Bill, me included. But if I think about it, I believe that what is or is not happening at EPA is going to have way more impact on a farmer's bottom line than is what's going to happen with this upcoming Farm Bill. You look especially at the new herbicide strategy and all the mitigation efforts that they want to make farmers do. And it's a big deal. It's going to be costly to do these mitigation measures. And they're going to require farmers to put them in place before they ever really know whether there's a fight between regulating pesticides and the Endangered Species Act. I don't believe I've ever seen a more dangerous proposal out of EPA. Now, I would say we and everybody else agree something has to happen to work out the differences with the Endangered Species Act, because if we lose court cases, it's going to be bad for farmers. It's going to be bad for every pesticide company. But we've got to find a more reasonable approach.
Anything else before we close?
We're also concerned about trade. I think a lot of people are concerned about trade. You know, this is a bipartisan issue. You know, President Trump didn't want to do new trade agreements, free trade agreements. Neither does President Biden. And, you know, they're the top runners in the next election, so I don't see anything changing for the next 5 years, presuming one of them wins. And that's a bad deal. We've got other countries going in, continuing to do free trade agreements, and slowly but surely stealing our markets. We got to get back to doing those negotiations.
Well, thank you very much, Mary Kay, for visiting with me here and getting us up to date. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or BSE, is a disease diagnosis that the cattle industry never wants to hear, bringing back memories of uncertainty and fear from two decades ago. Though time flies, 20 years ago, the first case of BSE in the United States was confirmed in a 6-year-old Canadian-born cow in Washington State. Since then, due to extensive and in-depth practices and protocols, few cases have occurred in our country, and globally, there has been a decline in the disease as well. The United States Department of Agriculture's Rod Bain shares more.
This past May, a case of atypical or spontaneous bovine spongiform encephalopathy was found in a cow in our nation. This was the first such case of BSE, or mad cow disease, in the U.S. since 2018. As USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service Administrator Kevin Shea points out, only 7 cases of BSE have been detected in our country since the first one was reported 20 years ago. In fact,
in the 1980s, there were as many as 30,000 cases per year around the world. Now there are fewer than 10 around the world.
A testament to safeguards put in place by the U.S. and other countries to prevent spread of BSE. Perhaps the most significant.
There was a real silver bullet in the worldwide fight against BSE, and that was determining that feeding cattle to cattle essentially spread the disease. So when cattle material got into feed in certain parts of the world, that was transmitted as the cows ate the feed. And so that was discovered to be the real problem. And so we in the United States, and just every country around the world really, put in a ban against doing that.
Another safeguard to prevent BSE.
We in the United States and every country around the world now removes what we call specified risk materials, mostly brain material, spinal cord material, from the carcasses of cattle that are brought into slaughterhouses for feed.
A continuing safeguard, one long in place prior to the 2003 U.S. BSE incident.
We also do lots of surveillance, and we've tested millions of cattle over the year to see if there are any signs of BSE anywhere. So those are the major steps we have taken, and it's been just an incredible success story really around the world.
One additional safeguard that protects our nation's beef supply from potential BSE contamination is a standard practice in the beef cattle industry.
The disease doesn't really manifest itself in younger cattle. It's only cattle 8 years and older. Most beef cattle in the U.S. go to slaughter within 18 to 30 months. So that's another safeguard that is in place.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Join me back here tomorrow for part two of this story and a look back at the cow that stole Christmas. For Agnet West, I'm Will Jordan.
We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Agnet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
AGCO is investing in talent acquisition across key product development disciplines to enhance precision ag technologies accessible to all farmers. In Scottsdale, Arizona, AGCO has inaugurated an acceleration center focused on software and electronics development in autonomy, precision ag, artificial intelligence, and digital products. The center takes advantage of the tech talent in the Phoenix metro area and nearby universities with a rich pool of engineering students. The facility, located at Skysong Innovation Campus, an extension of Arizona State University, collaborates with ASU researchers to support startups and inventions. It marks AGCO's second acceleration center affiliated with a university, following the success of its center on the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus that opened in 2018. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is set to distribute over $223 million in Pandemic Assistance Revenue Program payments. Producers who experienced a 15% or greater decrease in allowable gross revenue for the 2020 calendar year due to the COVID-19 pandemic will be receiving the assistance. Aimed at addressing gaps in previous pandemic assistance, PARP benefits a broader range of producers, including underserved communities, small and medium-sized producers, and those in livestock and non-traditional crops. The program received over 38,000 applications, totaling nearly $7 billion in triggered payments, exceeding available funding. To ensure equitable distribution, a 9.5% payment factor has been applied. These payments complement the nearly $32 billion in pandemic assistance already provided through various other programs. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. Agreements with California water agencies have been made to conserve up to 643,000 acre-feet of water in Lake Mead through 2025. The agreements include approximately $295 million in new investments from President Biden's Investing in America agenda, funding projects for water conservation, efficiency, and protection of critical environmental resources in the Colorado River system. Water conservation agreements have been established with entities such as the Coachella Valley Water District and the Imperial Irrigation District. The investments aim to improve and protect the stability and sustainability of the Colorado River system, utilizing an all-of-government approach administered through the Lower Colorado River Basin System Conservation and Efficiency Program. The conservation agreements in California join those in Arizona with a total commitment of approximately 980,000 acre-feet of water through 2026. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. Applications are open for the 17th annual We Believe in Growing Scholarship, a collaboration between E.M. Tharp and World Ag Expo. The opportunity is designed to promote agricultural education and encourage Central Valley High School seniors to pursue careers in agriculture. Eligible students from Madera, Fresno, Tulare, Kings, and Kern counties must plan to attend a four-year college or university focusing on agriculture. Two students will each receive a $10,000 scholarship. The deadline for applications is January 19th. To apply, students need to complete the application, submit two letters of recommendation, high school transcripts, and graduate in the 2023-2024 school year. The scholarship winners, to be announced in early February, will also be recognized during the World Ag Expo. Information on the scholarship is available at worldagexpo.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
An important trade announcement from the EU. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai applauded the European Union's announcement that it's extending the suspension of tariffs on U.S. goods. She said in a statement, for the past 2 years, the United States and the EU have engaged in critically important negotiations. She continues to say, our goal is to negotiate a forward-looking arrangement that will allow us to join forces economically to incentivize fair and clean production and trade in the steel and aluminum sectors. She points out that challenges remain as two new wars have started and global economic disruptions have continued since the negotiations began in 2021. She says these are technically complex negotiations and the United States remains committed to our partnership with the EU and to staying at the table to continue the progress we've made so far. She adds she's glad that the EU has announced that it's taking steps to join the United States in extending the time for these negotiations. If you wished for a holiday gift of lower grocery bills this holiday season, you're in luck. Gary Crawford has the good news.
Ah, the holidays, a time of giving and getting gifts, or having wishes magically come true. Well, I don't know about you, but for me and for many people all year long, our wish to Santa was that the rapid run-up in food prices would at least slow down, maybe even go into reverse. And guess what? Like holiday magic.
Hallelujah! Hallelujah!
Of the 22 food categories that we track, we saw price decreases for 15 of them from October to November.
This from the government's Consumer Price Index report as analyzed by Agriculture Department economist and food price tracker Megan Schweitzer. In a so-called normal year, grocery store food prices usually go down a little bit during November with all of the holiday supermarket specials and such. And indeed, for the first time in a couple of years, that is what happened last month. Now, the government puts food into three categories. First, grocery store food, so-called food at home. And then there's away-from-home foods that we get at restaurants. And finally, what is called all foods. That's a combination average of the first two. So let's look at the all food category. And according to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, the all food index during November went down by 0.2%. Not a big decline, but
that's the first time that the all food CPI has fallen since November of 2020.
So the all food index right now is about 3% higher than it was a year ago. Meanwhile, at our local supermarkets, the price decline was even deeper.
Food at home prices or grocery prices fell by 0.5% in November and were about 1.7% higher than November of 2022, than this time last year. And that's the slowest year-over-year growth in food at home prices in about 2.5 years.
Wow. So this latest Consumer Price Index report, definitely a consumer-friendly report, with prices for several products going down from last month.
Some of the categories where we saw price decreases were beef, which decreased by 1.3%. Pork especially saw a large price decrease this month, falling by 2.8%. Poultry prices declined by 0.9%. Processed fruits and vegetables prices fell by 2.9%.
Some foods not only went down in price from October to November this year, but were costing less than they did November a year ago, including eggs, fresh vegetables, pork, dairy products, and fish and seafood. So definitely seeing food price inflation cooling down, that's a holiday gift we can all celebrate. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. We go to Chuck Zimmerman now for a discussion with the Clean Fuels Alliance.
I'm visiting with Tom Verry with the Clean Fuels Alliance. And Tom, first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the fact that we have another conference coming up, first of the year, basically. Is there anything you want to tell us to let people know what you guys are going to do this year?
Well, thank you, Chuck. Yeah, absolutely. Our conference is coming up in Fort Worth, first week of February. And I think our conference is really going to showcase how our industry has evolved over this past year. We got new markets that are very interested in using our fuels, biodiesel and renewable diesel, to help reduce their carbon emissions, their carbon footprint. And so a couple of industries really going to showcase are marine and rail. So they are both getting a lot of pressure from their customers to reduce their carbon emissions, to help their customers reduce their carbon emissions. And that's that portends very good things for biodiesel and renewable diesel producers.
And rail is still an incredibly important part of our supply chain, right?
Oh, extremely. Our industry relies on the bringing the inputs and taking our outputs and get it all over the country. As you know, Chuck, most of our fuel is produced in the middle part of the country, and we ship it to the coast, east, west, and west, and east coast, west coast. So, yeah, absolutely critical.
This industry has really changed from back when we had the first conference as the biodiesel conference, and now it's clean fuels. How would you characterize what it was then and where it may be now?
Well, yeah, we both go a long ways back, don't we, Chuck? I think 2006 was our first conference in Palm Springs. And so we had no idea what to expect. We thought maybe if 300 people would show up, it would be a hit. 600 people showed up, and just we were overwhelmed, and in a good way. And so I think we kind of The first conference, I think we framed it, is where Woodstock and Wall Street met. Remember that? We had a lot of people maybe on the Woodstock side and a lot of people on the Wall Street side. But we all came together and we all agreed on biodiesel and now, of course, renewable diesel. So there's still a lot to that. And I think, you know, looking at our conference coming up in early part of next year, it's going to be probably more business focused than it has in those early days where a lot of our producer members meet with their customers and do the deals. A lot of fuel is sold, renewable diesel, biodiesel is sold during the conference. I know a lot of our producer members are booked all day long doing customer meetings. So it's been a really great platform for our industry to come together and conduct business. But, you know, we still like to have a little of that Woodstock. The environmental community is very important to us. And so there will be representative. We're going to be talking about how we're getting our carbon down, how we're working with environmental justice communities to work with them. They have a serious communities located by the ports and the rail yards, the truck yards. In the Midwest, we enjoy all this nice clean air. But my friends on the East Coast that live by the ports said, "Well, all the stuff that you buy comes through this port, and I gotta breathe this air." So it's a fair point. So, and we can help clean up that with our fuels, biodiesel, renewable diesel. So we're going to be talking about that. I'm looking forward to it. It's always great. A lot of great energy, and looking forward to meeting a lot of people you only see during the conference.
It's kind of like we've gone from the tie-dye T-shirt to the coat and tie, you know, where we had people like a Willie Nelson or a Daryl Hannah to, you know, people now who are leaders in major corporate entities, you know, and it has been a real evolution as the industry's grown.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Chuck. We had a lot of grassroots environmentalist involvement, and we still do. They really came with a different approach. They mostly are, you know, Palm Springs. A lot of them are coming from California. So, you know, there's pretty hardcore environmentalists there. And most of us were coming to the Midwest, probably not so much like that. But we came together and we figured out how to work together because we both see the value in what our fuels can do. And so that's kind of the neat part. And you mentioned Daryl Hannah and Willie Nelson. And, gosh, we had a lot of celebrities in the early days. I guess our celebrities we get like Pepsi on stage talking about they want to use biodiesel in their fleet and Maersk Shipping using biodiesel on the high seas and Southwest Airlines want to use SAF, sustainable aviation fuel. So it's been exciting to have those, still having the celebrities, but maybe a little different form now.
Well, we are looking forward to another great conference coming up in Fort Worth real soon after the first of the year. And a good time for those in the Midwest because, you know, we're south where it's a little warmer maybe at that point.
Yeah, it'll be better than mid-Missouri, I'm sure. We hope so. But, Chuck, you've been part of this from the beginning. So you've been able to see the changes and the growth. So it's been exciting. So it's been great to have you be part of our team from the very get-go.
Well, we were, with the headquarters in Jefferson City. We just happened to be there when I was managing what's now Brownfield Ag News. So we've always had a great relationship and have thoroughly enjoyed working with y'all.
Sunny beaches of Florida. So.
Great to talk to you, Tom, and give us a little bit of a retrospective of over the years with the what's now Clean Fuels Conference. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here's Brian German with this week's Almond Update.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. At the Almond Conference earlier this month, Vice President of Global Technical and Regulatory Affairs at the Almond Board, Julie Adams, sat down with Chief Ag Negotiator at the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, Doug McCaleb, for a one-on-one chat.
Well, we are all very excited that this year Ambassador McCaleb from USTR was able to join us here in California for the almond conference, which is the only gathering of the entire almond industry that's held. So this is really great to have you out here.
Thank you, Julie. And I'm really excited to be part of this conference. Almonds do so much to contribute to the health and the wealth of the United States. It's an honor for me as the chief agriculture negotiator to represent almonds and other commodities globally in marketing and trade deals. And it's just great to be here and to visit with the growers and be part of this conference.
Well, and so much of what we do in almonds is export-based. I mean, we're 70% export. So we're shipping to over 100 countries, so we're certainly diversified in our interests. But for us, making sure that we get credit for what we do and all of the activities we have in place really help keep the industry moving forward is an area that we're focused on.
Yeah, that's so true. So if you look overall at the agriculture export picture, we have set records nationally for the last 3 years in terms of agricultural exports. But I think a major focus for the Biden-Harris administration is to ensure that everyone is benefiting from agricultural trade. And so we have placed a large priority and focus on specialty crops, certainly tree nuts, and trying to ensure that we're opening new markets around the globe and where we can reduce tariffs or to get an equitable playing field for commodities like almonds, because it's so important that we set up a situation where growers can be successful and that we're able to capitalize on consumer demand around the globe.
One of the things that we often discuss in the almond industry is producing in California means you're probably meeting standards that are stricter than any that you would see virtually any place else in the world. But it feels as though sometimes we're not getting credit or recognition for those requirements, and we're being asked to comply with standards which just seem to add more cost and burden to the industry. Is that something you see we could really start to see some benefits from?
Yeah. As I engage in international trade discussions around the globe, you know, it's clear that the consumers know about the quality of U.S. almonds. They know about the high reliability and the consistency. But in many cases, there can be a government that is putting barriers in place based upon what they feel are justified regulatory requirements. What I don't think those governments always understand is that, especially for growers in a place like California, the level of stewardship for soil and water quality, wildlife habitat, air quality, all the plethora of regulations that farmers in California grow under means that there is a high level of stewardship already being practiced and already being invested into that crop of almonds. So part of what we are doing at USTR is to make sure that we are an advocate, a voice, that we are ensuring to defend and to help take credit for all of those investments and the level of stewardship that California growers are putting into those products.
Well, that's certainly an area that we want to cooperate and collaborate. I would say from the Almond Board perspective and as an industry, we're investing in a lot of research. We're investing in programs not only to help growers, but to help them tell the story of what they're doing. So anything that I would say we could do to ensure that you're getting that information to help engage in the discussions you're engaging in would certainly be good for us to know, because we want to be sure that you're armed with the facts that are going to represent the industry.
Oh, thank you, Julie. We have really appreciated the partnership with you all. The information that we get from the board and from the growers is incredibly valuable to the trade negotiations that we do. And so keeping that coming will certainly be very important in the future. Likewise, the administration has placed resources and an emphasis on helping with export promotion. And so recently, The administration announced $1.2 billion to help on export promotion and to place a special emphasis on specialty crops like tree nuts and to place an emphasis on developing markets in new areas around the globe. So we certainly appreciate the partnership and want to do our part to help leverage and to help resource the market development that needs to happen globally.
Well, we've already seen a lot of the benefits of the work you've been doing lately with some of the retaliatory tariffs in India coming off. I would say going forward, continuing to engage in Europe and also in China with seeing ways we can keep product moving is really going to be essential. Any new markets or areas you think we should be looking at or opportunities that you would recommend we pursue?
Yeah. So, Julie, you mentioned some of the progress that's been made this year. We were very pleased to see tariffs reduced on several tree nut types in India. We're certainly going to continue to put an emphasis in that part of the globe and putting additional resources into trade discussions there. The administration is placing a lot of emphasis and work throughout Southeast Asia. There are tremendous market potential in Southeast Asia with a growing middle class, many consumers who are interested in the kinds of products that we grow here, including California almonds. So there's tremendous potential there. Generally, there's a lot of work that will be going into Africa over the course of the next year, a lot of countries there that are a very good fit for us on farm products. But rest assured, USTR is all around the globe and in every continent, and will continue to be in the corner of California almonds to help push for an equitable trading atmosphere and open as many markets as we can.
Well, that's certainly good news, and it's an area we'll happily be working with you on. From our perspective, we want to look at growing demand around the world, and that means finding a way to keep it profitable, not only for our own growers, but to ensure the economic development of communities and keeping that demand with our customers growing. So anything we can do to work together, I see this as a great partnership.
We see it as a great partnership as well, Julie, and just appreciate all that the Almond Board of California does. It's really impressive work that, again, the results are things that we can take to trading partners in negotiations around the globe and to help advance our objectives.
You know, growers are really facing some strong economic headwinds right now, and cost of production is really high. What are some of the opportunities you see coming about that might help growers in that sense?
Yeah, as chief agriculture negotiator, we certainly push for market access in other countries, and we push for, you know, favorable trading conditions. But we also work on products that are coming into the U.S., including inputs that farmers use for their production. So producers may not be aware that earlier last month, the administration announced the reduction of the duty on phosphorus fertilizer coming out of Morocco. This was a really substantial reduction. The duty had been near 19%. It's now down to 2%. In addition, USDA has placed about $900 million into domestic fertilizer production and fertilizer resource development. So again, we recognize that we can push for new market export opportunities for U.S. farmers, but at the end of the day, the farmer also has to pay the bills, and that needs to be a positive ledger sheet. So the administration is absolutely looking at all angles possible to make sure that at the end of the day, farmers are able to be sustainable and to be able to remain in positive economic conditions. So just appreciate being here at the conference, and it's really an excellent opportunity for us, and just appreciate the chance to visit with you.
Well, thank you again, Ambassador Michaela. This is terrific.
Thank you, Brian. We will be right back. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour, and now for more news. Members of our nation's aquaculture industry have the opportunity to share information via USDA's 2023 Census of Aquaculture, with surveys to be mailed out later this month. Rod Bain reports.
What is aquaculture? Based on USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service,
For the purpose of its once every 5 year survey on this industry,
aquaculture is defined as the farm of aquaculture organism, including bait fish, crustaceans, food fishes, mollusks, ornamental fish, sport or game fish, and other aquaculture products. So farming involves some form of intervention in the rearing process, such as seeding, stocking, feeding, or protection from predators.
Travis Averill of USDA NAS adds what aquaculture per the 2023 census of aquaculture is not.
People that are collecting fish, crustaceans, mollusks, or other aquaculture products which are caught or harvested by the public from non-controlled water or beds that are considered wild caught. Those are not included in our aquaculture process for the census of aquaculture.
For those who produce and sell aquaculture products, they have the opportunity to go into greater detail about their operations and in turn help shape their industry in the future through the upcoming Census of Aquaculture.
The Census of Aquaculture is a very comprehensive process where we're actually getting information on the production of aquaculture, the sales method of production, the sources of water that are used for their facilities, point of first sales outlets, aquaculture distributed for restoration, conservation, or recreational purposes.
So what is the connection between the Census of Agriculture and Census of Aquaculture?
And the Census of Agriculture for 2022 is the main contributor to the Census of Aquaculture. So if an operation fills out the Census of Agriculture in 2022, they will be followed up with the follow-on process for Census of Aquaculture for the year of 2023. And we're asking for operations that have over $1,000 worth of aquaculture sales or the potential for those producers.
Census of Aquaculture surveys will be mailed out starting December 18th, with response required by January 15th of 2024. Surveys can be returned by mail or filled out online at www.agcounts.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.